I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation is what we do with global attitude. We're talking here with the great American novelist Russell Banks, who reminds you what the great novelists, think Tolstoy, Dickens, Hugo, Joyce, are for, to dream up stories that illuminate the social and emotional reality of their times and nations. Russell Banks is one of those writers in the Dos Passos tradition in this country whose imaginative forge is solidly founded on history and social context. In great American novels like Continental Drift, a tough love story about a New Hampshire French Canadian who meets a Haitian woman and her two kids in exile in Florida, or Cloud Splitter, the abolitionist John Brown story as reimagined by his son Owen. Russell Banks' new book, Dreaming Up America, is something else again. It's a conversation about the country, all context and history, no plot. The story is us, in this year 2008 when we choose between John McCain and Barack Obama. It's a form I love, the prophetic or at least deeply intuitive artist thinking out loud about whatever it is we're all going through. He makes you think of other conversations we could have with writers in this watershed year. He nominated the voluminous writer on the road, William Volman, also the Nigerian we met in Jamaica who lives in Los Angeles, Chris Abani, also the U.S. Poet Laureate, Belgrade-born Charles Simic. So think of this as a first crack with writers on America today. I asked Russell Banks to begin with a short reading from his new book about the American dream.
John D. Rockefeller didn't believe in the American dream, but everyone who worked for him did. He believed in the dream of empire. Ford didn't believe in the American dream, but all those guys assembling Model Ts and Model As down on the assembly line, they did. Those Irishmen and those Italians and those Greeks, they did. All those Hungarians and Poles in the steel yards in Pittsburgh working for Carnegie, they're the ones who changed American society. Carnegie didn't. They sacrificed and worked very, very hard for many, many years, for generations. And the dream they believed in was still believable because it was human scale, focused on individuals and strengthened through family ties and in local communities and labor unions. It wasn't the distorted and corrupted dream of empire. So, of course, my American heroes are not the Carnegies and the Fords. They're the people in the mines and on the assembly lines, in the steel yards and on the docks. They're the people who laid the railroads across this country, the Chinese and the Irish who were digging the canals. Every society has its captains of industry. Europe had its captains of industry in the first two decades of the 20th century. What Europe didn't have was that enormous labor pool willing to sacrifice itself in the workplace, a labor pool that was for the most part literate, that's important as well, who forged our national identity as a nation of immigrants, with not one but many identities, who came together to sacrifice and to build.
Russell Banks, everything about this book, Dreaming Up America, fascinates me, including the method. You were interviewed by French television, in effect, to tell the story of America, almost, yeah, you know, unrehearsed. And yet it comes from the mind of a novelist. It reminded me of Victor Hugo, mm-hmm, at his best, explaining France to France, or Norman Mailer, or some of the big epic novelists in this country. And I find it hugely rich, the sort of thing only novelists can give us.
Yeah, well, it did come about purely by accident. I mean, it's a spoken text, basically, and a result of 11 hours of my ranting and yapping and reflecting and meditating and ruminating on the relationship between American history and how we imagine American history, and especially how we imagine it through films, but also fiction, novels, and so forth, and trying to get at the place where the two meet. I think this French filmmaker Jean-Michel Meurice was making a documentary about American films, historical films that use American history, everything from Birth of a Nation to Black Hawk Down, right. And he asked Jim Harrison, the novelist, and myself to be the talking heads for this television film, and it ended up about 20 minutes time on film, but I had this text. I had the transcript of this 11 hours of rumination that my French publisher thought would make an interesting book, and she had it translated and published in France. And then I thought, well, actually, it might make an interesting book in English as well, and Americans might enjoy reading it as well as French. So Seven Stories Press brought it out here.
Well, it's very instructive. It it calls on a novelist's imagination. It makes a kind of conflicted character out of our whole story. And I think it gets to some big, big points early, as the best novelists do.
Yeah, I was trying to set out early on sort of the origins of the American dream, and not just that simple-minded notion of the American dream is to end up with a house in the suburbs with 2.4 children and a secure job with a pension in the end. It's more complex than that, and it's more controlling than that. And so from my point of view, and this, again, I suppose is a novelist perspective rather than a historian's or a journalist's or social scientist's perspective, is that I saw it as there being at least three main strands woven together, braided together from fairly early on, but starting in the late 15th, early 16th century in the Caribbean and the Deep South, when the Spanish arrive looking for gold primarily and seeing the continent as some vast storehouse that could be lugged back, the goods of which could be lugged back to Europe, to Spain. And then the middle states, the middle Atlantic states from Virginia north up into New York, where the Dutch and to some degree the French and the English came basically to trade and for mercantile purposes. And then in New England, where there was this fundamentalist group of Protestants who were looking for a city on the hill, a place where they would feel safe and free to worship God in their own way. And they kind of come together fairly early on, and they're driven in one important way by a fantasy that applies to all three in a sense fairly quickly, is that fantasy of starting an over of a new life, that fountain of youth. You know, I mean, that's an interesting fantasy. It's a psychotic fantasy, of course, because it basically flies in the face of mortality,
but it's why we have health clubs, right?
I'm afraid so. Yeah, but it's a powerful one, and these strands kind of very early on, really by about the 17th, early 17th century, start to come together as those different zones of the continent end up politically aligning themselves. And these three disparate groups from Spain, from France, and from England end up becoming something else, something they begin to think of themselves as Americans, not as Europeans, not coming from a specific European country or culture. There's something else forming there. And it's driven by these dreams or fantasies, if you want.
So you have the city on the hill, a kind of spiritual mission, the Puritans. Mm-hmm. You have the city of gold, commercial otherwise, and you have this city of reinvention,
right,
of beginning again.
Yeah, the fountain of youth, right.
Yet, take them apart in 2008. In this very, very challenging moment.
Yeah, well, as long as you believe in that those three dreams are not fantasies, that in fact they are realizable, reality will accommodate them, then you're easily manipulated. And you can see our politicians using the media and the media allowing itself to be used by and large to feed those fantasies, the fantasy of freedom, the fantasy of wealth, and a fantasy of starting over, of rebirth and renewal without necessarily changing anything. I mean, that's I think the trick if you're running for office is, how do you get people to vote against their own self-interests? And one way is to make them believe in a dream, and that's what I think, you know, all the politicians that are running for office today, although the three main ones are doing, feeding that dream.
Explain that. What are the versions of the American dream that you see being sold to the public, sold to American voters in 2008?
Well, the first one is the one that if you work, I mean, listen to Hillary Clinton talking about hardworking white Americans voting for her, supporting her, as if they are going to, by supporting her, find their sacrifice of their lives, their you know, that they have laid down their lives basically in order to obtain that material security, that it's going to somehow be returned to them, that that goal is going to be realizable if they support her. So there's one dream there. I think Obama's feeding another dream of change and renewal, that the history that surrounds us and the conditions that that surround us, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's in the economy or whether it's the racial divide and the class divide in this country, that they're going to magically go away by voting for this centrist Democrat, which is nonsense, of course. He's not proposing any structural changes, and that's the only way those things are going to begin to go away. So, and then there's McCain, who's feeding us the fantasy that really, I guess, of control, that somehow the military might of the U.S. will prevail across the globe, that idea of power and control. And these are fantasies that are being fed by the politicians and being bought by the people, packaged and sold to the rest of us Americans, when in fact they're not so much lies as delusions. And we're bound to be disappointed once again.
That's
interesting. We have bought them ourselves. We will have
say it again. I've got to be.
But we will have brought it on ourselves by supporting these politicians and by ignoring any candidate or any ideas that might conflict with those dreams. I mean, we're still subjected to them. We get up and march to those tunes.
Are they equally dangerous, equally deceptive dreams, do you think?
I think it depends on who you are. If you're an Iraqi or trying to run your little life somewhere, then the McCain's dream is probably the one that's most dangerous. If you're a working stiff, white or black, in Pennsylvania or Ohio, or a poor farmer or something in Tennessee, then... Hillary's and Obama's dreams are, if you're a kid, you know, a 20-year-old kid who thinks, my God, you know, American blacks and whites and young and old and rich and poor can get along and work together and change this country, then you're going to be disappointed too. There's no way any of these three candidates can help but destroy our hopes and our dreams once they're in office. They feed them while they're running for office. They nourish them, nurture them along, flash the imagery. And then as soon as they're in office, it seems perfectly obvious nothing will happen that will be that will allow those dreams to be realized.
That's a pretty grim view. Yeah. An African-Jamaican-American writer said to me last weekend, deeply invested in Obama emotionally, but said, he may be an imperialist in the end, but it'll be a better version.
Yeah, he's our imperialist.
Not quite ours, but an imperialist tempered by an empathy with the brown people, I suppose.
Well, that might be so. I mean, he's speaking to what is perceivable about Obama's character. One might have said the same thing about Jimmy Carter at some point, you know, a decent man, a good Christian man, et cetera, a man of a certain amount of integrity. When he ran for office and became president, a humble man, we thought of him, the man from Plains. But once he was in office, he was just like every other centrist Democrat. He was he didn't operate any differently because he didn't have the power to change the institutions that govern our lives. Whether he had and he didn't have the will to do it either. He didn't have the program. Neither does Obama, and neither does Hillary, and certainly neither does McCain. And when we're voting for those three, we're voting for images, we're voting for symbols. Their programs practically overlap, especially Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And so it's a symbolic presence of a black man, as he's perceived in the United States and in the world, by and large, becoming president. And it makes us feel good. It's a feel-good moment. But the programs that he's proposing up and down and all around are really the same old centrist Democratic positions. And the same people are going to be running the show as have run the show. I mean, all the corporations are rapidly switching their contributions to the Democrats. And when they're in office, they're going to look around and say, well, who do we owe here? Do we owe those voters or do we owe the guys who paid for the TV time?
And now Rupert Murdoch, I don't know if you heard this, and now Rupert Murdoch says The Obama election will be a landslide. It's now inescapable.
Who's he saying it's a landslide for? McCain or Obama? He thinks Obama, huh?
Yeah.
Well, he's Australian, not. But no, I don't think so. I think it's going to go the other way. I think that we are taking false comfort in the fact that George W. Bush is only got a 28% favorable rating. That doesn't mean that it isn't going to be another 49% split in the vote, and that middle 2% is going to tip it one way or the other. It's going to be that same 2%. Mainly it's going to be white males, working class males mostly, in states like Florida, Ohio, and Michigan that are going to tip the election to McCain. They're not going to vote for a black man. I mean, I live in upstate New York, in red New York. It's not blue New York up there. And it's one of those places that go exactly the way the rest of the country goes. I mean, it's soft Republicanism. And I know from the guys that I talk to and hang out with at the local pub and watch ball games with that they're not going to vote for Obama. And they don't like Bush.
Russell Banks, sitting there in Saratoga, New York, explaining this country to French television, you said this American bullying and imperial impulse is absolutely nothing new that we're seeing in Iraq. I question that, but make your case.
Well, the scale is new because the technology of the early 21st century is superior to that of the late 19th and early 20th century. Had we had the same means, I think we would have operated more or less the same way because the motives and the intentions were the same when we went into the Philippines and or even go back further than that to 1845 to the Mexican War and the land grab of the Southwest. Had we had the technological means to induce shock and awe, I think we probably would have. We did the best we could given the limited technological means at the time, but the impulse was very much the same, and the entitlement was very much the same. Grab what you can grab. I mean, we went into Iraq with the same motivations that we went into Cuba and the Philippines, and the same motivation we went into Mexico way back in the 19th century. So I don't see any big shift there, except the amount of armament and the kind and quality of armaments that we're using.
Surely there are links, but I must say, in my own bubble-headed way, I thought there was something egregious in the Bush doctrine, the unilateralism, the naked militarism, the sort of no questions, no excuses, we're coming in, like it or not, with a mission of domination. There won't be even a close second to our power in the world. This was further out than we'd ever been before, and a kind of warning that for which we're now getting the comeuppance.
No, there was that grandiosity driven by a sense of American exceptionalism and national nationalism, that kind of blind nationalism. But now I don't think that it's all that new. It's just rephrased. There's a wonderful piece by Mark Twain written during the Philippine War. I think it's To My Brothers Who Sit in Darkness. I think that's the title. And it's a parody of the rationale for going into the Philippines and saving these poor benighted souls from their own darkness and saving them for Christianity, capitalism, and civilization—the big three C's—and and we basically are doing the same thing: saving the world for those three C's: Christianity, capitalism, and civilization.
Mark Twain said at that moment, "The American Eagle's talons don't belong on any land but our own." That was in his non-satirical moment, but he was great. William James was even greater, in my opinion. Yeah. Even then, Mark Twain, William James, Andrew Carnegie in the Anti-Imperialist League were a minority voice. You're right. How do we explain the kind of popular open lurch toward empire in the last 10 years?
Well, maybe we ran out of land. We reached the sea. If you look back and notice how Americans moved west, those very early maps of Connecticut and Virginia and so forth extend westward all the way into the unknown west. I mean, those 17th century maps, 16th and 17th century maps, as if the west were our backyard. And so the settlement and the movement into the west
you know, legalized with the purchase of the Louisiana Purchase, of course, but regardless of that, was really a sense of entitlement that the continent was ours. We could move west, and it didn't matter that there were millions of people already residing there, and we simply had to displace them and take over and make it safe for our three seas as well. And then we ran out of land when we got to the coast, and we couldn't go north. The Canadians were too nice and too much like us, and we couldn't go south. We'd already done that, done the Mexican part, and so where were we going to go? We looked around, and we had the means and ability to go to Southeast Asia and now to the Middle East. And it's sort of like look around and see where's the gold, you know? Well, the gold is oil now, and so we moved to the Middle East.
It was. Anyway. I mean,
what?
Well, it may have peaked.
It may have peaked.
Yeah.
Well, I think eventually, yeah, your supply lines get too drawn out. It's like Napoleon marching into Moscow after we can't any longer supply our legions out there in the Middle East and in Afghanistan.
But there is also, Russell Banks, that other voice in American history, John Adams, knew that the undoing of a republic was empire. Oh, yeah. So did a lot of the other founders. Ronald Reagan himself, you know, he used to say, well, God put this great nation between two oceans for a reason. He was creating something new, mm-hmm. an American. I can't imagine Ronald Reagan would have gone to war in Iraq. He was out of that isolationist streak, or maybe just the Republican continental notion of a fairly isolated, special America that could let the rest of the world go hang. Do you see that impulse in the American myth of itself revived nowadays, 5 years into the war in Iraq?
You mean a kind of isolationism?
Or even just mind your own business, Uncle. Come on back home. As Ronald Reagan said, you know, you wouldn't want a nuclear war. It would ruin the whole day in America.
Yeah. But meanwhile, he was happy to go into Grenada, and he had his own feints and dodges.
That was kind of a hair of the dog invasion. I mean, it was just a little token to make, you know, to on the way back home, let's take an island out there in the Caribbean.
Yeah, and then there was Bush 1's Gulf War. Following on hard on the Reagan years. No, I don't think. You see, I think you're talking personalities in a way, and you're talking as if a president has more power than he or she actually has, and the impulses that are driving these this wars now and the war on terror, so-called, are really underneath it all economic and driven by certain institutions rather than simple ideology. I think the ideology follows the desire. The desire is there, and the intention is there before the ideology comes out as a rationale to save the world from itself, as it were. And that what's going on now is really an attempt to achieve a kind of economic hegemony. Given the tools that are available, the technological tools that are available, you know, the so-called global economy, you know, and to try to make the center of the global economy right here in the United States. That's what I think is driving an awful lot of this.
But where do you see it going from here? This America that you describe has hit a kind of wall militarily in Iraq, and we're also being warned all over the place that, wait a sec, you've taken your eye off the ball. China's arrived. Europe is a power in a new way. You got to get back in the race in a very, very different, humbler, hustling way, Uncle Sam.
Well, I don't see that being argued very strenuously anywhere, certainly not by any of the leading political candidates. And I don't think that most Americans actually feel that way. I think what will happen, frankly, is that we're heading for a crisis, an economic crisis of enormous proportions that probably not since the Great Depression have we had to face anything like it, and maybe even worse than the Depression before we're through. and only that will change institutions and our true sense of what government's responsibilities are, just as the Great Depression did in the 1930s. You know, it was a crisis in capitalism, and it's so extreme that it forced government and the people to rethink the responsibilities and the intentions of government, government institutions. And I think we may be forced to do that yet again, and it's going to be a very painful process.
Take it apart.
Well, I think it's obviously linked to oil, to our consumption of energy and our dependence upon fossil fuels. But it's also linked to our expansionism, our military expansionism. I mean, it's a $3 trillion affair right now, and it's probably only going to go up over time, as long as we continue enough. And if we do another, you know, surgical strike into Iran and so forth, and are forced to expand even further our forces in the Middle East and elsewhere, it's going to break us. We'll break the bank. It's real simple. And we're living in a kind of Ponzi scheme, the economy, the American economy, based on debt. At some point, the banker has to come and call the chits back in. And when that happens, it's going to collapse like a house of cards, like any other Ponzi scheme does. And
the banker being China or Europe?
At this point, it was both, yeah. And if they switch from petrodollars to eurodollars, from U.S. dollars as a basis for the price of oil to euro, which they're about to do, I think, anyhow, then we're in deep trouble. And we're going to have to go through the kind of painful reevaluation of ourselves and restructuring of our economy in order to accommodate those conditions. England and France had to go through a painful reevaluation of themselves when their empires no longer functioned, when they could no longer afford to sustain them. And it was not, fun for them. Luckily, they didn't go through, at the same time, a huge economic crisis. And so it wasn't quite unendurable. But we're going to, I think, have to go through both.
Different kinds of people are seeing this sort of thing. Kevin Phillips, who grew up with Richard Nixon 40 years ago, says exactly this, in fact. I wonder how you think this American character, this American dreamer, will respond.
Well, I think of myself as patriotic and not nationalistic, but patriotic. I love this country, and I love the people who live here and have lived here. And I love the few guiding principles that we live by or try to live by that are embodied and expressed so beautifully in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, what Ralph Ellison called our sacred documents. Mm-hmm. And we need periodically and have periodically returned to them and reconfigured our sense of our country and our destiny as an ongoing creative process. And there have been those moments where it's occurred. There was a brief moment after the Civil War, where the attempt at Reconstruction, which got so ugly so fast and so thwarted. There was that moment, I think, in the 1930s and a brief moment in the late 60s, early 70s, where you see that return to the idea of the country's history and destiny as a process, a creative, ongoing process that the people themselves participate in. And so that's the faith that I have, that a crisis is a terrible thing, an economic crisis of the order we're describing here and predicting. But on the other hand, it will force us, to take our own destiny back into our own hands. At least I hope so. I can't say that. I believe it. I really do believe in American people's sense of that right, belief in that right. They just have to every now and then be reminded that it is their right and to control their own destiny and to take it back.
Do you connect that coming crisis, Russell Banks, with this churn of energy most conspicuous in the Obama campaign?
Yeah, I think fear of that crisis. Yes, I think there is a widespread fear. There's a sense that there's a shadow falling across this great blue sky that Ronald Reagan pointed at so happily, that it's not morning in America anymore. It's evening in America. And I think that people have that sense. And it hasn't been articulated very well by our leaders or even by our leading pundits and thinkers and commentators. There's just been a few out there who have been warning us of this fact. But I think the people, my friends, people I know, and I'm not talking about intellectuals now or academics. I'm talking about the guys down at Baxter's Tavern in Keene, New York, and people, working people, have a sense that they know now they're not going to live as well as their parents. And their kids aren't going to live as well as they are unless something really serious changes and something basic, fundamental, has to change. And so I think that that's generating a lot of the interest in Obama. African Americans and youth are tending to lead the way, but that's not unusual in America, that African Americans and young whites see more or less the same thing out there. And I think people who have been alienated, felt alienated from the process in the past, are starting to pick themselves up and look around and say, we better do something about this, or my kids aren't going to have the life that I had, and I can't have the life my parents had. This is a downward slide. I can't afford a house. I can't afford college education for my kids. I can't afford to put gas in my car. I can't afford to live in the town where I work. You know, they're facing it.
Economics is one big dimension. I also sense in my own kids a sense that we can't be who we thought this country was, either at home or in the world.
Yeah, I think that is. And that's the other side of this crisis, is that that realization that the dream of empire is a vain and foolish dream and an unsustainable one. And I think that that the kids and those who have been alienated from the process for the last few generations see it first. They can see that. You know, it's the guys who live in the bubbles in Washington and New York and Wall Street and so forth. The people making hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars a year and so forth don't see the problem. You know, they say, what's the problem here? I don't have a problem. What's your problem, Jack? And so we can't look to them for advice, guidance, and leadership, because for them there is no problem. They're doing just fine, thank you.
One of the premises in this wonderful interview with French television you did was simply that movies and novels, to some degree, are the real register of something under there. What are the instructive films or documents out of popular culture today that tell you the weather?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to explore. I'm fascinated by this plethora of superhero movies about men, almost every case, who are stronger than humanly imaginable, who have superpowers, various kinds, from Spider-Man to Iron Man just out, and so on. And the enormous popularity of those movies, what does that suggest to us about the need are those movies meeting? And a sense, I think they're in response to a sense of powerlessness. You know, there was a time when those were comic books that were read by pre-adolescent boys primarily, who tend to feel really powerless. And I remember when I was a little guy, I loved those comic books because I just felt like I had absolutely no power in the world. I was a skinny little runt of a kid. And so I just projected that onto these superheroes. And I think that, you know, the audience for those movies is not just kids. I mean, those are vast numbers of people going to see those movies and getting a big thrill out of them, a big hit. And I think that they tap into that said growing sense of powerlessness, powerlessness in terms of the larger world, controlling events outside our immediate bailiwicks, but also sense of powerlessness with regard to our own lives, the shape and form of our own lives. And those movies, I think, really tap into that. I mean, movies are projections, you know, the movies that, in fact, were not successful in the last couple of years were movies that purport to be quite serious movies about reality on the ground in Iraq and in other parts of the world. With a great deal of money put into them, and they flopped, one after the other flopped. People didn't want to go out there and see that ugly, hard truth. That doesn't mean they don't believe it's true. It means it's just too painful to look at right now. And so we'd rather see Spider-Man or Iron Man or whatever, Return of Superman. It's kind of a drugging state, you know.
Are there books out there that point the way?
It's hard to say, you know, because our literature, contemporary fiction particularly, tends to float in two directions, to the paranoid, really paranoiac despair of something like Cormac McCarthy's The Road or Don DeLillo's work or something like that, to simple domestic escapism and melodrama. There's not a whole lot in the middle that is trying to investigate the world that ordinary people live in and see it from an angle that will give us historical perspective. You know, one of the things that troubles me sometimes about contemporary American fiction is that it's much of it is written as if there were no historical context for the characters, as if there was nothing else going on except the melodrama or the immediate daily life of these characters, when in fact we all have historical context. I mean, you know, I might be sitting here worrying about balancing my checkbook or my wife's illness or this or that, but in the meantime, there is a war going on, and there is probably the most important election, or possibly the most important election of the last half century going on. So there's a context for everything that happens to me on a daily basis, and I think too much American fiction leaves that out, perhaps for some of the same reasons we were mentioning. Or if they do write about history, they use it as a gimmick, as 9/11, for instance, you know, has appeared periodically in fiction in the last few years, but it's basically a stage set.
Russell Banks, it's such a privilege to hear you talk. Your book, this interview with French television, strikes me as a complete vindication of, first of all, conversation, talking to the other, also a kind of general reflection on who we are and where we're at, but also of the novelist's imagination. It seems to me throughout this campaign, you make me want to interview nobody but novelists, imaginative students of the American heart and mind. If you had a wish list, who would you invite to the party to... I mean, you'd love to hear Faulkner. You'd love to hear Hemingway. You'd love to hear Mark Twain. You'd love to hear Henry James. But among the living... Who are our guides? Our Victor Hugos?
They're alive and well. I mean, a number of them: Gabriel García Márquez, Americans, Toni Morrison, much acclaim, but also worthy of that acclaim. They're out there. Don DeLillo is one who's certainly out there. I admire enormously. Robert Stone. These are writers who have a world vision, really, and they see us as a people amongst in a galaxy of peoples, and rather than as someone exceptional and indifferent. I admire enormously Cormac McCarthy too. I mean, there is a phalanx of writers out there in working today, doing remarkable work. It isn't a question of that. It's not about writing and doing the work. That's being done. It's about being heard and listened to. I mean, it's interesting to me is that of all the political candidates out there, not one of them has a novelist on the staff or an advisor sits down with novelists, at least to my knowledge, over dinner and drinks. I remember when Bill Bradley was running, I knew him slightly, but I knew Cornel West very well. And one of the things Bradley used to do periodically, he done regularly, not just once in a while, but I think about once every few months, was convene a weekend in Princeton, New Jersey, with Cornel West and a few others, an economist and a philosopher and so on, and sit around and let them let him ask them questions. What do you think about X, Y, or Z? And educate himself, in other words, from their point of view. And they weren't policy wonks. They weren't marketing people. They weren't pollsters. They were intellectuals, artists, and so forth, imaginative people who had the big picture. And I don't think anyone is doing that who's running for office today. It's hard to imagine.
It's kind of an uptown Hilton Head weekend.
Yeah, but keep it, you know, keep it small and keep the billionaires out, and just sit around free forming. I think that that would be useful for some of these people.
So do I. But I'm trying to think of a president who would have been comfortable with a real free-thinking novelist, and I can't think of one.
Well, actually, Clinton was. Clinton loved hanging out with Bill Styron and Marcus. I know that they spend a couple of weekends together. Clinton was very comfortable with writers and poets and so forth. He had a great memory and has a great memory, I suppose. He still has it. Loved to recite long passages from Faulkner, which he could do. It's a bit of a show-off, of course, but no, I think he enjoyed it. But other than Clinton, I don't think there's been a president since JFK who was willing to sit around in the room and ask questions of novelists and writers and poets and so forth.
I think of Norman Mailer just loving JFK, but that, even that was a wary relationship.
Yeah, as it should have been. I mean, rightly so. Both of them had every good reason to be wary of the other.
Does it console you that Barack Obama clearly writes his own seriously searching prose?
Yeah, I think that's terrific. I mean, that's a positive thing, very much so. The question for me is always, what's he going to be like after he's been in the Senate 10 years or after he's been president and run for president for 2 years? These experiences change a person. For instance, I knew John Kerry slightly way back when, you know, when he was in the beginning of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and so forth, and spent a little time with him then. And I thought then he was an extraordinary man. All right, after 16 years in the Senate, he turned into a bubblehead, basically, because he lived in a bubble. And that's what happens, I think. You know, they exteriorize themselves over time until there is no there. There's no interior left. And Obama certainly has an interior life, a rich and vibrant one, as evidenced by his writings, and I think as evidenced by his actions up to recently. Now, can he preserve that interior life given the requirements of a public office in America today? I'm not so sure. You know, actors go a little crazy, politicians go a little crazy, musicians go a little crazy because they lose their inner life. They become they're etherealized into the media. They're sucked up and packaged and sent out the other side, and there's nothing left. Whether, you know, in the past, a politician could run for president and not really leave the front porch too much, you know. I mean, you get on a train and ride across the country once, make a few speeches, go to the convention, and cut the deal. You had a private interior life. You weren't turned into a product the way we turn our politicians and our public figures into products. Writers have the same problem on a much diminished scale, artists and intellectuals too, because the world, the media, wants to make you a celebrity. And the danger of that is that in the process, you will lose your interior life, and it's your interior life that you depend upon for your work.
Put three younger writers, under 50, should we say, onto the plane with the winning candidate, who would they be?
Good question. Well, actually, I would like one of them to be a non-American. You know, I think someone from the third world. There's a great young Nigerian writer living in Los Angeles named Chris Abani. And I would put Chris on. And he's also outspoken, intelligent, reckless, high energy, and a brilliant writer. And he knows the world. And I would say, among American young American writers, there's one I really like and admire, named William Vollman, who has been everywhere and has written about everything from prostitution in Southeast Asia to the Balkans to hoboing across the country on railroad trains. He writes both fiction and nonfiction. He has a kind of eclectic mind that gathers in that finds every life worth examining, from the most ordinary downtrodden to the princes of captains of industry. Every life is worth examining and understanding and sympathizing with. So I would include William Vollman. Now, you know, beyond that, let's see, there are dozens of writers that I would want to sit down at that on that plane and talk to whoever was the winning candidate. Think of Rick Moody, who writes about the suburbs of America, or has in the past, with a great elan and intelligence, Amy Hempel, great short story writer with enormous passion and sympathies. I think we should have a poet there, though. I think, you know, you got to have a poet or two sitting down and working with the president and bending his ear or her ear, I think.
Nominate one.
Oh, let's see. They don't have to be necessarily that young. Sometimes it's better to have poets a little bit older and more seasoned. I would say Charles Simic would be a great companion traveling. I mean, he's a friend of mine, and I've traveled with him, so I know what a great traveling companion he is. But he was born in Belgrade and came to America as an adolescent and grew up in Chicago. Was in the United States Army, went to college by hook and crook. Later, now the poet laureate of the United States. A man who's one of the great poets of our time, but he too sees the world from an international perspective, and I think that's the thing that we have to get close to whoever has power, is that international perspective that diminishes our sense of exceptionalism and diminishes and challenges our nationalist impulses and forces us to confront our limitations and also at the same time acknowledges our gifts.
Now you're sounding optimistic, as if it can be done.
Well, we just had a dream team here on the plane. That's all that is. It's an American dream team.
Russell Banks, it's a huge pleasure to read your work again, and especially to hear you about this country at this moment on Open Source. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.